it was very sinister because I thought I was on this, like a game show almost. And I started to have like this idea that I needed to kill myself to save the world. And there was a big security guard in front of me and he had a gun by his side. And I just had this voice going, put the gun in your mouth, take that gun off him, put the gun in your mouth and pull the trigger. But when you pull the trigger, a flag's gonna pop out the end with bang written across it and that's gonna be the show over. You'll have proved that you're not a coward. If you take that gun and you put it in your mouth, it will prove you're not a coward. Because I'd felt like a coward. Every time I drank, I felt like a coward.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today.
I'm really excited to introduce Michael Cannon today. Michael is the author of Hunting Concrete Lions, which was the finalist for the Best Book Awards for The Independent. He's an entrepreneur and received a BSc from the University of Derby. Formerly a celebrity fitness trainer in Hollywood, Michael is the founder of a behavioral health company in California. He's also very tall, handsome, muscular. For those listening, it's worth a watch on YouTube. And you probably can't believe how he is today compared to his story. It's unbelievable.
So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening.
Michael, thanks, mate, for joining me on This Is Powerful.
Paul, thank you very much for having me.
I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I'm dreading it. I'm looking forward to it on the same note. It could go anywhere.
Mate, your book, Hunting Concrete Lions, blew me away. I haven't read it for a while and I want to reread it. But I found you were so honest of the journey of someone who suffers from addiction, but you described the emotions, the mental trauma, all the devious stuff, the lies and cunning stuff, what people go through. What made you write the book? And the title, by the way, what does that actually mean to you?
They're good questions. What does the title mean to me? I mean, the title, so Hunting Concrete Lions, it was like this idea of looking for happiness outside myself. You know, it was, how can I make everything look good on the outside so nobody would know how I was feeling on the inside?
Because I'm assuming that the lions are like on
the gates of a big house.
The gateposts of a big house
with a jacuzzi and a pool and a big yard. And I'm thinking, you know, if I can get that, then nobody would ever know how I was feeling.
Yeah.
And what made me want to write it, I think, you know what, mate? I think I just wanted to be rich and famous.
Really?
No.
Is that what the drive was? Because,
do you know, I was sober probably, I'm going to say like 14 months at the time. And, you know, this part of me that was like, oh yeah, you know, you want to be, I'm living in Hollywood and like, I'm going to do this thing. And I always loved the, I think there was part of me that was, you know, I had aspirations of being the next Hemingway. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Hopefully with a happier ending because he blew his brains out.
Yeah, exactly.
But I felt like I'd had such a transformational experience that I felt I had a responsibility to share the story. And in 2009 it was, I had a ghostwriter in the UK, which I turned down. I got approached and he said, you know, I'd love to write the books for you. At the time, I thought this would be brilliant, but I actually wanted the challenge of writing the book because I felt like I wanted to do it. You know, I wanted the challenge of it. So I turned that down and thank God I did, because there was two sides to the story. It was like the bravado story, because I felt at the time, even though I was sober, I still felt that, you know, there's more to go here. And there were still bits of the story. And it was only, I mean, it took me 8 years to write the story. And all that was writing, rewriting, editing,
polishing. So you didn't have any ghostwriters, you've done the whole thing
No,
yourself.
I did the whole thing. Right. Yeah, I had an editor, you know, which was, and the book's as good as it is because I had an editor, I needed the editor. But it's the texture, you know, I wrote to begin with 12 hours a day, round the clock. I was living in Cyprus at the time.
Not obsessive at
just,
all.
Just totally, but it was cathartic. Yeah. And the more that I wrote, the more that I got into it. And there was days where I would just laugh out loud every single day. Do you know what I mean? When you start finding the truth, because there's that part of me that wanted the, you know, I got the girl, I got to, you know, a nice area, California. I got to all, you know, Hollywood and celebrity fitness training. There was a story there that was like, and I was like, that's not the story. That's just not it.
Talking of stories, I want to ask you how the hell you get from Isle of Man to California. But just to let our listeners know, you're from Isle of Man.
I'm from
here. How all I know about Isle of Man is that there's a TT there. I haven't been.
Yeah.
That it's lovely. It's beautiful. Little fishing villages. It has its own parliament.
Yeah.
A lot of car shows are done there because there's no speed limit, which is why I want to go. But what's it actually like to be brought up? What was your upbringing like?
My upbringing. You know, it's funny because very normal. I say this now, you know, in the context of like comparing to, you know, having lived in Hollywood and all that and seeing both sides of it. You know, my first recovery meetings were in sort of Compton.
Yeah.
So you see, you know, you've seen all sides of life. And growing up on the Isle of Man, it was quiet. It was safe. I grew up and there was a Viking burial ground in front of the house. So you got this Viking heritage over there, which is just fascinating. It's got the oldest parliament in the world, which was like 11th century.
Yeah, what's their, they've got a weird tradition, right?
They've got, yeah, they make, their parliament is called Tynwald. And each year they bring out this Nordic sword, make the rules up, and then everyone just goes down the pub and celebrates. So they're basically, it's self-governed, do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
they're basically making up their own rules.
Well, it seems to have worked.
It has.
But I mean, in the aspects of, so I was brought up in London on the last stop east.
Yeah.
There was, not so early on, but as I got into my early teens, a lot of people around me started to experiment with puff,
yeah,
with hash, way before ecstasy come in, and obviously drink and stuff. And people go to the park, start drinking in the summer holidays. Usually someone gets hammered and throws up.
Yeah.
Was that there, or was it really quiet that you didn't see any drink and drugs? And when was your first experience?
There was always drink. Drink was the big one. I mean, I always heard the Isle of Man described as 80,000 alcoholics clinging to a rock.
I thought
that was just the best description. But it was so normal, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was like a bar and a church on every corner. So people would just be, you know, they would go to church and then they would go down the pub. You know,
so was it a romantic idea? Like, was it just a normal, nice thing?
It wasn't... I mean, these are small, like, you know, the town that I'm from, little fishing village, you know, the guys would come in off the boats, everybody would be getting drunk. It was just a thing you did,
yeah.
You know.
So how did you get into, because you, in your book, you describe about going to get heroin and crack. That's what I'm trying to get to. How did Michael from the Isle of Man for this little fishing village end up, first of all, going to Liverpool, right, you said?
To begin with, there was like really not much drugs on the island. So you had to know the right people. If you wanted to get something like heroin, you had to know the right people because it would come into the Isle of Man and then the prices would double. And at that time, you know, I'd experienced divorce in the family when I was about 11, which was a traumatic event for me. And I sort of went off the rails. You know, it's funny because my sister I've got an older sister, and we went textbook opposite directions. Like, she was going to save the family from shame, and I just wanted to pull the house down. So I just found drink and drugs and hanging out at the pool halls and that sort of thing. So I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and, like, nobody's to blame. You know, I made the choice to go and do that. I wanted to do it. And I think with something like heroin, I was thinking, if I'm not shooting it, I'm not a junkie. So if I'm just smoking heroin, everything's okay. Until one day I woke up and I started to have these flu-like symptoms. And I'm like, I must be getting a cold or something, you know. And then next minute, I'm taking some heroin and I felt a bit better. So I'd crossed over from into that physical addiction.
How old were you then, Michael?
I'd have been about 15, 16.
Wow, so young.
Young. But it gripped me right from the beginning. You know, I had no idea that, you know, at that age, it just gave me this profound sense of, like, acceptance. Like, everything made sense. I had no idea I was dealing with shame and guilt and fear and resentment and self-loathing and jealousy and anger, rage, you know, all that was in there. Yeah. And this drug just seemed to neutralize that. It just made sense of everything. Like, my life made sense to me.
It's interesting because I was a good athlete when I was a kid.
Yeah. I can still see you. Sorry to interrupt you. I can still see you in that gymnastic leotard.
Cheers, mate.
But my go-to was athletics. Like, I just loved the trampoline because I would fly. I'd feel free. Right. And I was very anxious as a child. I found life hard. There was a lot of animosity around and, you know, and I say violence, not in my family, but there was a lot of hostility in the times anyway. And I could feel it. I felt very open to feeling stuff. So I really exerted in sports and I loved it when I was boxing. You didn't think of anything else apart from training and feeling fit and stuff. And you were the same because you was a really good athlete and a footballer.
Right.
How was there no thought about, because you're physically incredibly fit now as well. So you've obviously looked after yourself now, but did you just let go of all of that?
That's a good question because I remember as a kid, sort of 4 or 5 years old, just waking up with that Saturday morning and I was going to play football. And the joy of knowing that I was going out, loving it. It was just thoughtless. And I would go out and my dad was the coach. So I grew up with a football from day one sort of thing. And just loved it and got into everything. You know, played every sport I could and you just really enjoyed it. And I often think about that young lad and like it was a state that I always wanted to get back to. Do you know what I mean? That joy of like, where did that go as the years went by?
I ask my question now. I always ask myself, you know, when I was in rehab, I think for the first 3 weeks and I made a decision that I was going to take my life.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do it anymore. I just sat there and thought, what happened to me? I love that,
mate,
getting up on a weekend, going to play football with the guys, running around, the fresh air, the lungs being filled, just being out, just being
pure
fresh.
Joy.
Yeah, just getting
pure
up and
joy.
What's happening today?
Yeah.
And knowing that completely disappeared.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to get up. And I wanted to just overeat, stay indoors, not look at daylight. I'm a morning person. I love the day.
Yeah.
And that really affected me to realize that that's where I was, but how did I get there?
I hear you. Something I thought of as the years crept by and, you know, the drugs got a hold and the anxiety and the depression and that feeling. And I just remember thinking, am I just getting older? Like, is this how I'm supposed to, like, what happened to that kid? What happened to the joy and the fun and the freedom and that, everything you were just describing? Hmm. And I actually thought, I must be just mature. This must be what it means to be an adult. I had no idea that actually the drugs and the alcohol were having an impact because nobody would say to you, hey, if you do that, you're going to, or you wouldn't, you don't know what depression feels like and you don't know what anxiety feels like until you're there. And it's crippling.
So you're 15, you started doing heroin, you realize you're getting feel like you're getting flu-like symptoms.
Yeah.
And that was fixing it. And in fact, that was fixing everything because it was blanketing over everything. How does that work in the Isle of Man? You know, you said you find somewhere, but how do you fund that?
Mum's purse, dad's wallet.
Right.
Do whatever you can. I always had jobs though as well. You know, I remember I had a job at, crikey, mate. The things that I've done, I was working as a postman at one point.
No way.
I was working at the bakery, so I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I would go to work and work till like 12 or 1 o'clock. Cleaned a mortuary. Oh, the things I've done. I was a real estate guy when I was probably 15, 16. I worked at the realtors where I would show people around the houses and stuff like that. Like I was willing to do something my old man always said to me. He said, you know, get a job and another one always comes along. So I always had it schooled into me. Like right from a young age, I was cleaning their shoes for 5 pence and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I would literally do anything, washing cars.
How did you get to university then after that? And how did you, was you using at university?
I took a year off after my A-levels. And it was in that year that I really experienced, like, you know, abusing ecstasy, taking a lot of speed, doing all those drugs. And in that period from sort of, finishing my A-levels to university, I was in an absolute mess. Was having panic attacks every day, like round the clock sometimes. I got to the point where I was agoraphobic, so I couldn't even leave the house.
Wow.
The fear had crippled me that much that I couldn't leave the house. And
did you associate this to the drugs, or did you think this
was something? I associated it with, at the time, I didn't really know what was going on. That's a good question. Like, I really, and it's such good information to know that you don't know. When you first start taking the drugs, particularly, like, you know what it's like to wake up with a hangover. But when you're taking something like ecstasy, you don't know what the side effects are. You just, you're so euphoric when you're taking it. You don't realize that we've got this inner drugstore and that's getting depleted all the time, and your body stops producing its own natural hormones, to make you feel good. And so there's this natural catastrophic consequences of taking it until, you're depressed, you're anxious, and I would go to the doctor all the time, but I was so afraid of telling the doctor the truth. Like, literally, I would go to the doctor and I'd be like, oh, I'm having a few sleep problems. I was bloody hearing things, seeing things, like anxiety attacks. I just could never, because I always thought if I told him the truth, there was some eject switch in the doctors that would just put me straight into the nut house. And my biggest fear was ending up in the nut house.
So in the book, you do this beautiful description of being strapped to a gurney in Santa Monica and taken off to a mental institution in Pasadena. So your worst fear was revealed to you.
Yeah.
That must have been terrifying. What preceded that, Michael? How do you get in a gurney? I'm laughing because it's awful, but how do you get in a gurney and get taken to Pasadena in the States?
That's a really good question. I think, even getting to the States was, it's like, how do you get from the Isle of Man to the States and then into a...
Well, yeah, because you'd have to have you must have got a visa to stay there. Like, how did that happen?
Which bit?
I'd love to know both things, but how did you get from the Isle of Man to
the Isle
Hollywood?
Of Man, that's a good... Yeah, so the Isle of Man to probably California is a good... I was 29 at the time. And, crippled with heroin, being a heroin addict for 7 years, full
on. Was you injecting now or?
No, I was still smoking. So I didn't think I had a problem at this time. And I was 29 years old and trying to get off it all the time. And I remember going to try and buy drugs in Douglas, the main town, and the police caught me, followed me. And I remember throwing the drugs out of the window. And they pulled me over, got me, took me to the headquarters, but they found this block of polystyrene it's like charred, burnt out polystyrene. And they brought it with me and put it on the counter when I went to the police station. And I was like, what the fuck's that? Like, am I getting stitched up for like a kilo? What? I mean, this was a big chunk of polystyrene. And because that's what they found after I'd thrown it out the window. I only had a little bit of gear, So I get to the police headquarters and I'm sitting in this cell and I'm just thinking, my whole life is flashing before me now. Am I getting stitched up for this block of polystyrene? So at the end of the day, anyway, like a lawyer came and they gave me my drugs to wean me off the heroin at the time. Like they give you something to sort of sedate you. So I'm in this cell. I'm just like, I'm going down. That's me. I'm done. And I was just, something's got to change. Do you know what I mean? Something's got to change. And the police I got away because we had this conversation. They were like, did you buy this? And I was like, it's a block of polystyrene. And so they were thinking I'd bought polystyrene. Like it looked like a black block, right? So, and at the time people were selling all sorts of shit on the Isle of Man, saying it's drugs. So they're thinking I've gone with the intention of buying drugs and ended up buying something from this dealer because it was a known dealer's house that I was at. And he came running out with his pajama bottoms on, threw the drugs in my car, and I drove off and the police pulled me. So I go to the police headquarters. I'm in there. We have this conversation. I just started laughing. I said, you can't seriously think I bought that block, did you? And they're like, it went on and on and on. And they were like, oh, we're going to let you go. They turned the house upside down. I'm saying it's my house. It was my mum's house. My mum had left. She'd gone to live in Scotland. She was like, I can't take him anymore. So she didn't kick me out. She left. And I remember sitting in that house and my dad came over. He'd never been to the house in his life. And I remember sitting there and it was the first time I confessed to him about doing drugs. And I was sitting there and I was black and blue from all the drug use, like literally black and blue. And he could see it on my legs. So that's when I confessed to him and he said, thank God you told me the truth. He said, it all makes sense now. He said, you've been out of your mind for 15 years sort of thing. He said, I just thought you were mental. He said, knowing that you were doing drugs is a huge relief to me.
Wow, amazing.
And it was one of those touching moments, you know, because I remember sitting on this piano stool and I was like, tears were streaming down my face. And my dad just said, look, get away from here. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I think the Isle of Man's the problem. I need to get out of here. So I got a one-way ticket to New Zealand.
So you went far?
See, I don't do things by halves. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, if I'm going, I'm going. And at this point as well, I was afraid of flying, terrified of flying. So I just had to like bite down on the mouthpiece, you know what I mean? And sit on that plane. They were shutting the doors on the plane. I'm like, this is a long flight. And I had, you know, heroin with me and I had all this medication. I mean, I was medicated off the eyeballs from the age of 16. I've had diazepam, nitrazepam, every sort of lorazepam, any sort of antipsychotic, sleeping tablets, you know, stuff to help me get up, stuff to help me sleep. And so I get to New Zealand and they don't tell you when you buy the ticket, you're going with you. So there I was. And I just recreated everything that I'd experienced on the Isle of Man. It was like, I wanted drugs and they didn't have many drugs. So I would look at the local newspaper at where all the shootings and murders were going on. And I would think, that's where I need to be. So I would take my car down there to try and score drugs in these just the worst places in New Zealand, you know. I tried getting a job. I was like, you know, all I need to do is get a job, get a bit of money in the bank. A mate of mine came over from the Isle of Man and joined me. So we're living in this sort of basement of this building in New Zealand. And I couldn't keep a job down. You know, I just couldn't function. And I was drinking and I was experiencing the progressive nature of addiction. Because people said to me, look, it gets worse. And I'm like, I need to experience it getting worse. I don't believe a word you're saying. I'm going to put my hand in the fire to test it. I know that's how I function. I was experiencing the progressive nature of it. You know, it's just getting worse and worse. And I was drinking in the morning, drinking to get in the shower, shaking, you know.
On top of all the drugs, because they're not working anymore?
They're not. I couldn't really get as much as I wanted on the drugs.
Gotcha.
So I'm functioning and I'm over there and you know the Kiwis and the Australians are big on their rugby. So it was 2005 and it was the Bledisloe Cup final. So it's Australia v New Zealand at Eden Park in Auckland. And my mate's with me and he's like, we've got to go to this game. We've got to go to this game. I'm like, no, let's watch it on the TV. And so eventually he talks me into driving to this match. We couldn't get tickets, so we pulled up outside Eden Park, the big stadium. We could hear all the crowd going off on the inside, you know. It was like, we got to get in. So I walk into the reception area, and the guy goes, this is the last two tickets to the match. So we got the last two tickets to the game. We go to the game finishes, I'm leaving the match, and I see this young lad with this lady walking out of the rugby match. And the young lad's spinning this rugby ball and stuff, and I'm looking and I'm thinking, blonde hair and all the rest of it. And he throws me the rugby ball. I catch the ball and he goes, oh, you know, he introduced himself and he goes, oh, what do you do? And naturally, I've just left a rugby match. I'm a professional rugby player.
Not a basement cracked out and drunk.
So I've told this lie, right? And the woman sort of turned around, introduced herself. I'm like, quite fancy this. So we go to this hotel in New Zealand and we sit down, we're having a conversation. And she tells me that she needed to get away from America because she was going through a divorce to a high profile athlete in America. And I'm thinking, I've just pulled off the sports-specific bullshit of a lifetime here. And I had my opportunity, because she said to me, you know, what, so you're a professional rugby player. And I had my opportunity to go, no, I was just kidding with your son. And I went, yeah, looked her straight in the eye and uttered not one word of the truth. So that started this lie.
Because because of the obvious that you wanted to impress her, because you thought she's nice.
And you know, I wanted to, like, this train wreck of an individual who's trying to keep his life together, you know, I need to be something else. I needed to put on that mask and just pretend to be something else. So it just felt very fitting that I was going to be this athlete.
And you look like it now. I don't know what you look like then.
No, I was heavier then. So I was probably 70 pounds heavier then, even though I was in denial about it, you know, trying to function back then. It was, but I was eating and drinking, you know, everything that goes with alcohol, you just can't.
I completely know.
Mate.
I get it.
Anyway, we started this long distance relationship. She's in America, I'm in New Zealand. And obviously now I'm fabricating this entire lifestyle to fit the lifestyle of a professional rugby player. I'm lying about a car. I'm lying about the drive of the house that doesn't belong to me, that I parked the car in that doesn't belong to me. I was driving around in a 1984 Mitsubishi that was all battered yellow with rusted falls to let the rainwater drain out. I mean, it was just so...
And what did she think you were driving at
the time? She thought I was driving a bloody Range Rover. And, oh, you know, I would send her pictures of... I think I had, like, you know, you could look on Google at the locations of where you live and stuff like that. And it was just... It started this progression of lies that just...
That's deep.
It is. And I can tell you, my mental health was proportional to the extent of the lies. It was getting worse and worse. You know, I would turn up in America. She invited me over, and obviously I couldn't afford to go. So I'm like trying to bullshit my way out of going to America. And she's like, I'll pay for it. Just put it on the... And so the whole time.
And she didn't buy that bit, because I've had, when I was modeling, I have had my face used a few times for people that ask for money off of girls. And the girls are messaging me and say, this guy is using your images to try and get money.
Right.
How did she not think?
Well, do you know, at the time, the internet wasn't enough, because I'd told her, I added the team that I was playing for. I said, I'm playing for the Bradford Bulls. Because an ex-girlfriend of mine really liked the Bradford Bulls when I was at university. So I was like, this came to mind, that'll do, that'll add to the story. And you couldn't, there was no information online.
Yeah, of course.
So it was at that time, 2005, where there just wasn't enough information. So I was like, I remember going home that night and searching to check that you couldn't find out anything about it. So
you went there. How was that when you went there? And I know that in your book you say that she didn't live too far from the Mexican border.
Right.
So this precedes the gurney conversation. So how did you start to get the drugs, and how long was you with her, and did you move in?
Yeah, so eventually we have this relationship, and I'm going over, she's flying back to New Zealand, and then just decided, right, I'll move in. So I move in. I mean, she had a color TV, so it was perfect. But I got there, you know, and it was, you know, I mean, it was everything I dreamed of. You know, it was, you know, the big house and the pool and all those aspirations I had as a kid.
This was your concrete lion moment.
This was the concrete lion moment. This was the concrete lion, because the title had actually come that a mate of mine, when we were about 15, we were sitting in the bar, the same guy that was with me in New Zealand, and he'd gone to the bar and he came back with a newspaper. And in the newspaper, there was a story about this guy who was going off around the world, sleeping with all these women and getting paid to do it. So we're 15 years old and we're thinking, this is just my calling. Do you know what I mean? Like, this guy's got it made. Do you know? So we're embellishing the story as the drinks are going. It's like, you know what? Imagine if we could get, like, this rich woman, maybe America, a big pool, concrete lions on the gatepost. We'd have it made. Be careful what you wish for. It's one of those moments. So
that's a good implantation from where you were and how you felt. It makes sense, doesn't it? Coming from all that pain on a small island to going, if I can get that. So what happens when you're there?
So I'm in San Diego, beautiful spot in North County, San Diego. it just got worse. You know, you think you've got, I mean, none of it was mine. It was, all of this stuff was hers. But I would lead people to believe, it was like, you ask me how I'm doing, I would tell you whose house we were at the night before. Or I would tell you the postcode, because it, you know, it was renowned postcode and all the rest of it. And the truth was, I was going down to the border every day. We were 25 minutes or whatever from Tijuana, and I would drive down, just cross over the border, go down, because I knew you could get drugs down there. And so I would go down there and thinking that this is the last day. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is the last day. I'm done with the drugs from this point here. Then I would go back, and then I would be down the next day, and I would go back. And eventually she just, you know, she caught on to my behavior, and she was just like, listen, you got to go. So she kicked me out, and I was in a motel in the area. And just, I remember being in this hotel room, and I was just surrounded by drugs and alcohol, and thinking, this is it. And so I actually tried to go back and knock on the door of her house and say, oh, can we talk this through? And she just shut the door on me. And I was like stood in the middle of nowhere going, okay. So I get back and I made a mercy call to my mom. My mom had always said to me, if there's ever a time when you want to, I can't help you anymore. You know, everyone was done with me. My family was done with me. I'd burned all my bridges, the lies, the manipulation, the deceit, like nobody want, and thank God, you know, it's like, if an alcoholic likes you, you're probably killing them. If they don't like you, you're probably saving their life. And so I'm in this room, but my mom had always said, you know, if you want help, I would get you into a 12-step program. You know, I would get you into like a rehab. And I said, you know, I made a mercy call to her. And, you know, still in my mind, mate, I'm thinking, I want the front row in Malibu, silk sheets, massages. I just wanted a break. Mm-hmm. You know, I had no real intention of getting sober. I just wanted to put some time between me and the drugs to show people like I'm not a junkie. And so she managed to get me into a treatment center in West Hollywood. And it wasn't what I imagined.
Wafting around in a silk bathrobe.
I was having a long
cigarette by the pole.
Mate, it was not what I had in mind, I can tell you that. So I get there and I just thought, you know, they had these 12 steps on the wall. I'm thinking, what is this Mickey Mouse American bullshit? Like, it just felt ridiculous. Like, 12 steps, what's that shit? So I'm in there and I remember saying to the woman after a few days, I'm like, you know what? I think I'm done with it. I'm ready to go now. And she said to me, you know, hang on. She said, don't go before the miracle. I said, what's this miracle she's talking about? So I'll give it another day or so. I started to like have this clarity. It was the most strange experience. But I started to, like, I just started to feel differently.
Were you detoxing?
I had detoxed for like 5 days. So at this point I'd been in there, you know, several days. And I'd obviously come off the drugs, but it wasn't a big come down off the drugs or anything like that. They bring you off the drugs safely. But what I had in my mind was like, I grew up with a lot of religion and stuff like that. And I started to question, like, had I got it all wrong? Had I got life all wrong? Like, had I interpreted all these sort of religious messages and stuff wrongly? Like, because I remember there was things like, there was a Bible in the room and stuff like that. And I remember thinking, you know, all that, was it like the allegory and the metaphor and the simile, all these stories, like I'd taken it all literally and I was absolutely terrified. And, you know, my earliest fears actually were around religion, you know, because I remember sitting in, I'm getting off on a tangent now, but I'm just thinking about what really prefaced this experience was, you know, being younger and growing up in a very religious situation. I remember being in church on a Sunday and they'd have the Jesus character nailed to the cross. Do you know what I mean? And I'd be thinking, if God did that to his only son, what's he going to do to me? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And I had a very vivid imagination. And I was thinking, well, what are heaven and hell? Like, this is obviously places I'm going to go in the afterlife, you know? Like, and I was terrified. And very vivid imagination. And I thought hell was this place that was under the church and the fire and the brimstones and the gnashing teeth and this demonic character with, the, you know, this red beast and truly, truly terrifying. So I'd grown up with all that stuff. And in actual fact, the woman that I'd met in New Zealand, she took me to a place called Agape in LA.
I went there. It's amazing.
So you know.
Yeah. Spiritual
and
church.
It's a spiritual church. Yeah. And now when I went in there, I thought I was betraying like my mom in particular and my family because like it wasn't what I grew up with. And I was sitting down like she was chipping in a bit of money to the church. So we got these seats on the front row and they made me feel very welcome. And there was a guy, I think there's a book called The Secret. There's a guy, Michael Beckwith.
That's
and he was conducting the services. And he stood there. And he went, there ain't no man in the pearly gates. And I thought, he's going to get struck down by bloody lightning, this guy. Like, I thought, this is blasphemy. Do you know what I mean? And so I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, but there was a moment where I went, maybe there's some truth to what he's saying. And I know it poked a hole in my belief system, what he said that day. Because you had all these people coming from a very spiritual place. Mm. It wasn't religious, although they took on board some of the principles and values that you would get in religion. And I wouldn't knock religion. I'm not religious today. I would consider myself spiritual. But they had applied. It was for everybody. And it was more just, I mean, essentially, it was just love. It was either, is it fear or love? And it was just, it was really a really good message about how to live your life in a healthy way. And I think that planted a seed with me of a direction that I was going to go in and really prefaced this experience that I had in rehab. Because when I was in rehab, I really started to think like, maybe I've got it all wrong. And I'd been chasing like money, power, and prestige all my life. And it had driven me to like, here I was in rehab, like that's what I got for chasing all this stuff.
Mm.
And I remember a guy walked past me and he goes, the air is free. For some reason, he just walked past and said it. And I flipped out. I just completely, it was like the punchline to the worst joke I've ever known.
Flipped out as into him?
Flipped out
or?
Just like, no, I flipped out in a way of like, just the simplicity of life. Like I've been chasing all this and I've the gratitude for like the thing that sustains me, the breath. It was just one of those moments. And so like I started to like, my brain was almost unraveling in a way that I was breaking down. And I was like, it got sinister, you know, and I started to feel like I was awakening, you know, like really waking up. And to me, it was a spiritual experience, like, but it was in the middle of hell because it got really dark. At one point I thought I was being abducted by aliens and all this religious stuff was coming through and I was like waking up. So at one point I was like, maybe I'm the second coming of Jesus, but a more advanced special agent version. Maybe I'm Jesus Bond.
I'm laughing. But I understand because I went through certain layers myself where I felt like I'd come out of a trip.
Yeah.
I'd come out of an illusion. An old story that wasn't mine, like a pattern, like the Matrix. And I kind of woke up and I was like, oh yeah. My God, what if they're right and I'm wrong? Wow. I remember having that specifically.
Yeah.
And I remember I had a few of them, but one of them was later on in rehab. And I walked down to, there was two Spanish girls that did the food and they were wonderful. And I walked down and as like Japanese people breathe as they speak, I was breathing, I spoke, I was like, can I have, and I was so floored and empty and open that it was the most, not painful, but it was so painful, but freeing at the same time. Mm. I felt like I just let go of everything. And I knew I was safe, but at the same time I thought, am I having a proper breakdown this time?
Yeah.
Is this a breakthrough?
Did you fear, like when you were growing up, did you fear having a mental breakdown? Because it was one of my biggest fears.
Not early on.
Right.
I feared a lot of things early on. I was like, when you said about Bond, I would sleep with my school uniform on and I had two bricks either end of the bed, because if when the house burnt down, yeah. I was gonna rescue everyone. I was this little kid who just, I was always on guard. And my dad did a few things to try and strengthen me up. Like when I was four, he made my mum and him drive away and leave me. And my mum said that she was looking at me crying at the window and she said she's never forgiven herself for it. I don't know if she remember that. But yeah. He used to do things just to toughen me up. So there was a whole protection thing. There was a whole protection thing going on. And I was always hyper alert. But then I did start to get this thing about heaven and hell,
right,
and light and dark. And am I being watched when I'm doing bad things and what's going to happen? So I did get that later on, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's...
After the rehab, was that in the rehab?
So that was in the rehab, yeah.
Did you tell anyone about it? Because it's pretty scary for someone to go through.
Yeah, I was going through it on my own. So I was in rehab, but I was just sort of literally going through it on my own. And I was sort of saying stuff to the counselors and that, but they were looking at me like, you're out of your mind type thing, but nobody was really, they should have been, I mean, ultimately I did get carted off, but it wasn't before I ended up in a really, really bad place. Cause I was like, I remember one point being curled up on the bed and my heart, I could only feel my heartbeat like once. And then it felt like 20 seconds went by and it would beat again. And I was burning up and sweating, and they called the ambulance, and actually the fire brigade came, and I remember them coming through the door and they had the defibrillators and they're like, he's going to go into cardiac arrest any minute. So they were stood over me like this, and then they put me on a gurney, carted me off in the ambulance.
I really feel for you at the moment. Sorry,
mate, it was as dark as it gets, because nobody really knew I was in America. The girlfriend had kicked me out. My mum and my dad had, you know, I mean, I'd burned all my bridges.
Whew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It,
Yeah, I hear you.
Oh, I thank you for that as well, because, yeah, it's...
After they took you from there, how was it? What happened between there and you actually getting this proper section up in Pasadena?
They carted me off to Santa Monica, UCLA.
Mm.
And... you know, if I let, like, I respect you for showing your tears now. Do you know what I mean? I really do. I fucking hell. It takes a lot of work for guys to cry. Do you know what I mean? That's a whole, I could go down that road.
Mate, I just completely understand.
I know you do. But almost feels like I want to respect that. It took me years to cry in recovery, mate. Took growing up. I know I'm going off on a tangent now, but like the ability to cry. You were talking there about, you know, your relationship with your dad. And I just think about the messages that we get growing up about what it is to be a man.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And we get that. We're disconnected between the head and the heart from a young age because we're told men don't cry. Mm. You know, stuff your emotions. Don't show anything. Otherwise, you're a fucking wimp.
Yeah.
You know, and it plays out in all sorts of horrible ways.
Because
you get this, that repressed emotion, the inability to emote. Like, the guys in my family repress their emotions till their fucking hearts explode.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's the problem, isn't it? Is that, God, I never cried. I realized that doing lots and lots of personal work, and I was a fighter, I was a really good boxer.
No, I know you were.
And I've had some really good brawls, and I don't get scared of many things. In compensation wise now, but the ability to let go is such an incredible journey. The relief that your body has to, I really feel like we're filters and you have to filter your emotions and you say stuff as it is, et cetera, et cetera. And to not be allowed to express yourself for a long, long time, you see it come out in anger and raging guys all the time. It's just suppression. And something that's suppressed has to go somewhere. That energy has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
When I was fighting, when I was boxing, I was rarely angry. I was rarely frustrated. And people say about boxing, some people say about boxing that, oh, you've got to be angry. And you are the opposite. You're controlled.
Mm.
You're mindful. You're a warrior against the opponent, whoever it may be. Like, I remember fighting for the British title first when I was 15. I had seven fights, won seven fights. I had five knockouts. It was hard for me to get a bout at the time. So I was thrown in with this guy, Joey Redden, I believe, from West Ham. I think he had 64 fights and he was the current champion. I think he had 62 wins. Like, he was experienced. And my old trainer was like, you're not going to outbox him, Paul, but you can fight him and beat him.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I fought this guy. But it wasn't angry. It wasn't anything. It was like, there's a skill in this, but you got to have heart. You've got to
100%.
Do that.
100%.
And what I'm saying is that now to be in touch with yourself as a bloke, to allow your emotions to go in and out and just speak freely is something that I would recommend anyone to do. It doesn't have to be drama. You don't have to walk down the pub and say, I'm going to have a cry. Don't do that. But do proper inner work.
Yeah.
And it allows you to be free from all that build up of stuff, which will want to take drugs or drink to relieve that.
Absolutely.
So when you do the work, you don't have to relieve something. There's enough. There's that saying, Michael, you know, that, oh, I was out of my head Friday. I want to get out of my mind. Or I want to get out of my box. If you want to get out of something, you don't like being in it.
Yeah.
So do the work to like being in there. You won't have to get out of it.
There you go.
You know?
Yeah.
So when you, from UCLA, what happened for them to take you then straight into Pasadena?
So, so I'm in UCLA and they put me on this bed and I'm still out of my mind. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm thinking at this point, I must be on some, like a TV show. I thought I was on the Truman Show. If you watch that film, like that's what was going on.
You probably are.
Quite possibly. I remember The Late Show with David Letterman was on the TV when I was lying on this bed. And I just had these religious thoughts, like, know the truth and the truth will set you free. Know the truth and the truth will set you free. It was going over and over on in my head. And at the same time, it was very sinister because I thought I was on this, like a game show almost. And I started to have like this idea that I needed to kill myself to save the world. And there was a big security guard in front of me and he had a gun by his side. And I just had this voice going, put the gun in your mouth, take that gun off him, put the gun in your mouth and pull the trigger. But when you pull the trigger, a flag's gonna pop out the end with bang written across it and that's gonna be the show over. You'll have proved that you're not a coward. If you take that gun and you put it in your mouth, it will prove you're not a coward. Because I'd felt like a coward. Every time I drank, I felt like a coward. I just thought this was my moment. This was my moment to prove that I'm not a coward. And so I was wrestling with it, like, because there was another voice going, this is not it, this is not it. There was like that little inner voice. But I was wrestling with that and I went to sit on the end of the bed and the security guard jumped on me, pinned me down on the bed. They put me in these 4-point restraints and they were shooting me up with all sorts of stuff, trying to knock me out basically. And none of it was working. So I'm there like hours. And this guy walked around the corner from the rehab and he was this big black guy and he had this black and white t-shirt on. And I'll never forget, he had this gold boxing ring, boxing glove on a chain around his neck. And he sat down next to me and he said, are you ready to tell the truth yet? And I was like, and all I was, know the truth and the truth will set you free. It was like, I thought, if I'm going to die, I want to purge my soul before I go. So he said, start. I said, I'm ready. And he said, start at the top. So I said, I'm a liar. I hadn't even admitted to being an alcoholic at that point. A drug addict seemed cool, but like an alcoholic, there was no way I was going to admit that. So I said, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I'm a manipulator, I'm a liar, I'm a cheat. And I just went down the list and down the list. And all I remember is I must have blacked out, fallen asleep. I woke up the next day and my head was completely clear. I had no signs of all the psychosis from the night before. And from that moment to today, I've not felt threatened by alcohol and drugs.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
So there was...
That's incredible.
That opened up the possibility of getting well for me.
And after that, you went back. You joined a 12-step program after
that? So that's how I ended up. From there, they actually took me to Pasadena. That's why I ended up in the... So they took me to this. Bearing in mind, at this point, my head is clear. I mean, obviously, I'm terrified. But I didn't have any signs of the mental illness from the night before. Like, it was something had happened.
Mm.
And so now I'm being taken to this maximum security mental institution in Pasadena. You know, I got there, there's barbed wire on the angle. You're taken in. People are like... I've got their girlfriends' names carved into their arms and they're hanging there drooling, sitting around a table playing with the abacus and stuff. And I remember sitting there and the World Series of Baseball was on the TV and I thought, it's fucking One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, this one, man. It was, and I just remember, because I remember they threatened me with 5-point restraints. They said, if you behave abnormally, you were in such a bad way the night before. If you behave abnormally, we're going to put you in 5-point restraints or we're going to give you electric shock treatment. So I'm sitting there thinking, what's fucking normal now? Like, how do I behave normally? So I'm terrified of moving. And then they escort me to this room where, like, the seat, the toilet was molded to the floor, the bed was molded to the floor, the sink was molded to the floor, like, windows this thick. And they shut the door. People are screaming down the corridors and stuff. But I'm lucid, you know, I'm like, I'm with the program and I'm just shitting myself thinking, how am I going to get out of the, like, how are you going to talk your way out of this one? Because nobody's going to believe you. And I had this fear of them, like, just medicating me off to the eyeballs and being in this nut house, nobody knowing I'm there and just like, that's it, lock the door. And
which is possible because that's what you see on TV.
That's what you see, yeah. So, my fears were valid. My fears were valid. So that was my journey into, you know, a treatment center. I went through a dual diagnosis center, residential treatment. I was diagnosed like bipolar 2, like the audio visual bloody jackpot is, you know. And so, yeah, that opened up. That was me there. And that really, for me though, it opened up. I think a good thing, you know, an important part of it for me is they told me I would need to be on medication for the rest of my life. They put me on all sorts of medication. The first one, I got like this severe reaction to it, ended up back in the emergency wing. But yeah, they told me like, literally, you are gonna have to have a sedentary lifestyle. You are gonna have to not get your stress levels high. You're basically a death sentence. They're like, you know, you're fucked. And you've got these authority figures telling you you're fucked and putting you on medication.
What year was that?
That would have been 2000 and... So I got... So my sobriety date is October 16, 2007. So it was, end of 2007, November 2007.
So how clean are you now?
So 16 years and 10 months.
And clearly you got off of all the medication that you was put on.
I got, you know, we go through a bit of a process in recovery and I was on medication for the first year of my recovery, but I felt good. I mean, we do this amends process where we go back and we try to repair the relationships that we've broken. And so after that, I was actually in Cyprus at the time, as you know, and I went to find I'd been kicked out of America at that point, which is a bit of a separate sidebar, because I'd done my amends and I tried to get back into America and they found, you know, a business card in my bag and they said, like, I'd basically abused the tourist visa, which allowed you to go in and out of the country every 6 months. So I got kicked out of the country and I ended up back in Cyprus. But I'd done the majority of my amends in that period of time and I'm back in Cyprus and I find this psychiatrist and I went and spoke to him and I told him my story. I said, and I remember the first question, he said, well, what? And I told him I thought it was Jesus and he burst out laughing. And he started to explain to me that it's a very normal occurrence in mental institutions. He said, 95% of people in mental institutions are from very heavily religious backgrounds. And all that dogma and misunderstanding of the what it's trying to say in something like the Bible, like taking it literally, yeah, it's going to fragment the brain. And you're going to have all sorts of beliefs that are false. And he said, yeah, it's a common occurrence.
Wow, that would have been a relief for you then to know.
Oh, mate, you have no idea. So I'm sitting there and he said, look, the way you are right now, he said, I would challenge the diagnosis on you. He said, I think you've got more of a borderline personality disorder that's been affected by shame and guilt and fear, and divorce has had a big impact on you, and religion. These are all things that I've been working through, you know, with the help of a lot of people. And so he said, look, I'm willing to bring you down off the medication. And so we've just made a process. And I would preface, if anybody's listening, I did this under the strict supervision of a psychiatrist. I would never encourage anybody just to throw away your medication or anything like that. But I came down and I just started to feel, you know, because these antipsychotics, they prevent you from feeling. And so I started to feel, and my feelings started to come back, and I got a lot of extra therapy and a lot of extra help just to thaw out, because I was so numb for so long. Everything you had described before, I relate to it, you know, getting told to shut down and just repressed emotion, and then being able to feel and coming to, and like feeling, you know, that vitality coming back, and that the vigor comes back and the confidence comes back. And you know, you start to feel alive, and you're like, this is what recovery is about. You know, and being able to express it, you know, being sitting with the guys and being able to express your emotions and them not shaming it or humiliating you or ridiculing you, but like saying me too and saying what's going on, not in a way that's, you know, just in a way that's straight down Broadway. It's just, there's a masculine, healthy expression of the emotions, because the emotions, that's what makes us human.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So anyway, I got off, and I honestly, mate, to get off that, I was medicated from the age of 16. So to get off all the medication, be completely clean off all the medication, like the recovery work gave me a chance to discover my way out of depression. And so grateful.
Yeah. And now you are living a dream. Because you do live back in California. You're an entrepreneur. You've got successful businesses. You know, you're an author. It's amazing. And you're a shining example to a lot of people, mate. Unfortunately, out of time. Been really lovely to talk to you, mate. Honestly, I really appreciate your honesty. And hopefully people will hear at home that you can come from, literally from strength in a mental institution, coming back to being the best person you can be. Absolutely. Completely lucid, super smart, very fit, very healthy, very aware. I always ask people, if someone's listening and they know someone who's in addiction, whatever addiction it is, or themselves, they're worried about where they're at, what should they do?
I think for the family members and friends of anybody going through addiction, I would say the best, and I suggest this to people, the best thing you can do is model a behavior. Like, the addict's behavior affects the whole family. And everybody ends up as sick as the addict or the alcoholic. So there's help available for the friends and the family of the addicts and the alcoholics. That can be hugely advantageous to somebody, because when we see people modeling the behavior, monkey see, monkey do. I think that's the very best thing you can do. And you start to realize it's an opportunity for me to work through my stuff too. To an addict or an alcoholic, somebody going through, or just depression, I hope if you get anything from my story, it's that thread of the truth, you know? And if you can find that gut level, just being able, even if it's to go to the doctor and say, hey, do you know what, really tell them the truth. They're only going to do the best with the information they've got. And it's the polar opposite to what you think. My experience with my dad, he didn't shame or ridicule me. He said, how can I help you? I thought he was going to stick it to me. Greatest fear. The doctor, as soon as I told him the truth, I can get medication to help me. I can start to get on the right path. So you start to get, and I know it's easier said than done, because sometimes we just don't know what the truth is. But just starting and even finding people who've maybe been through it and who can hold a bit of space, a bit of a safe space, and to share their experience. I love what you're doing with the charity. I think it's absolutely phenomenal. To be able to take, like, somebody in your situation as a public figure, to be able to take that and go, you know what, I've crushed it over here. I was at the top of my game for 15 years, but actually the place you've got the most experience is in recovery. And you know, I would echo back to you, like I just respect and admire, and doing what you're doing with the charity is just phenomenal. And there's helplines out there. And just that it's the opposite of what you think. People genuinely care. People give a shit and they want to help.
Michael Cannon, thank you very much.
Paul, thank you.
Give us a hug, mate.
Oh, you've done me there, son. Oh, you completely done me there.
Oh, mate, that was amazing.
Thanks,
mate. This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Marti, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholford.